Hello, I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice, and you're listening to The Writer's Voice. Today we have Garth Stein with us, the author of The Art of Racing in the Rain. Garth, thank you very much for joining us.
It is my pleasure.
The Art of Racing in the Rain. This is not your first book.
No, it's my third.
Your third book. Mm-hmm. Are you a writer or a racer?
No. I'm a writer. I tell stories. I did do some racing. I raced with Sports Car Club of America, SCCA, for about 4 years. So that's where I've kind of got the background. But I am a writer by profession and a car enthusiast just for fun.
What kind of car do you drive when you drive on a racetrack?
Well, I raced a Miata. Spec Miata was the class I raced in. So that's really the only class that I ever raced. That and MX-5, which is a later generation Miata. They changed the name of it. I've driven a lot of different cars on the racetrack. My father used to have a very nice Porsche Carrera 4, which I enjoyed taking out to the track. And there's also the Lotus Exige, which is very popular in the racetrack in Seattle where I'm from. So I've raced that, not raced, but driven that on the track as well. But, you know, you can really take anything out onto the track. The better it's prepared as a track vehicle, the more kind of fun you're going to have. But street cars are certainly welcome on a lapping day.
When you were racing, were you also riding, or was riding something that you took up after your stint on the track?
Well, it kind of... I raced before I wrote this book. I used to make documentary films, and I eventually got a little frustrated with the process of procuring funding for that, and I realized that I was spending 90% of my time raising money and 10% of my time trying to be creative. So that's when I turned to writing. My first book came out in 1998, and then in 2001, in addition to having a couple of kids in there, I was living in New York at the time. My wife and I and my two older sons moved to Seattle, and that's when I started getting involved in racing. In New York City, there's not a whole lot of racing, or it's a little bit more competitive in a slightly different way, with taxi cabs and all. But when I moved to Seattle, where my family's from, where I grew up, that's when my father said, hey, let's go to the racetrack, because he was a big enthusiast. And that's when I got bitten by the bug, and I started to race. So I raced from 2002 to 2006. My second book, However and Broke His Head and Other Secrets, came out in 2005. So I didn't start writing this book until the summer of 2006, really when I was kind of backing off racing, because I was spending a lot of time on the road promoting my last book, and my kids were getting of an age that I really wanted to spend time with them rather than weekends at the track.
You combined in this book a wonderful story, I think, with a lot of philosophy, and some of that philosophy, it seems to me, has been stated through the eyes of a driver, though you're not writing the book from the standpoint of a driver. You're writing the book from the standpoint of Enzo, a driver's dog.
Right.
Talk to me about how you chose the voice you would write in for this book.
Well, it's interesting that the voice of Enzo came before anything else. When I was making documentary films in New York, at some point, a friend of mine asked me to take a look at a film. It was made in Mongolia, and they were looking for a U.S. distributor for it, and they thought maybe I had some connections. And so I looked at this film, and it was very interesting, very beautifully done. It was called State of Dogs, and it was about this idea among the nomadic people in Mongolia that the next incarnation for their dog will be as a person. And I didn't get involved with the film, but I really was interested in this idea. I thought, wow, that's really provocative. You know, your dog is like wandering around thinking, I can hardly wait to become a person.
Well, Enzo
has
watched that movie.
Well, right. The movie that's in the book is the movie that I saw. But I didn't really know what to do with that, because I didn't know how do you tell the story about a dog wanting to become a person. So I was at a poetry reading in Seattle, and the poet Billy Collins was reading. He was a very popular poet. He's really wonderful. And his poems are always very funny and very poignant. And he was reading a poem of his called The Revenant, which means words from the dead. So it's told from the point of view of a dog who's recently been euthanized. And the first line of the poem is, I am the dog you put to sleep, as you like to call the needle of oblivion. Come back to tell you this simple thing. I never liked you. It was very funny. And the whole poem is very funny. And, you know, this kind of dog with his complaints about his previous life. And I realized, oh, that's how I can tell the story. See, if I tell it from the dog's point of view, then he can have an attitude about the fact that he doesn't have thumbs, but everyone else does. And when he tries to make his tongue make words, it just doesn't work. And my dog, Enzo, as I wrote him, developed into a much different dog than Billy Collins' dog, not nearly as acerbic as Billy Collins' dog in that poem. But that was what it took to understand, oh, okay, so if I tell the story from his point of view, he can have philosophies about everything around him because he knows, because he's seen this documentary, that he's going to be reincarnated as a person. Therefore, he's preparing himself. And so he's studying all of mankind, humankind, in order to glean details that will give him an advantage when he comes back as a person.
Well, he watches a lot of TV in the book.
He does.
But he also watches his owner, Denny. Mm-hmm. Could you read a little bit
for
us from the book?
I'd be happy to. I'll read from chapter 3. It was an interesting process writing this book because it went very quickly for me. I wrote the first draft in only 4 months once it all came together for me. But it's got a lot of very short chapters, which is not the new book that I'm writing right now. It's funny, it's just the way every book is different. This new book has got these really long chapters. So the pacing on this keeps up. So here's an entire chapter, chapter 3. Very gently, like there are eggshells on your pedals, Denny always says, and you don't want to break them. That's how you drive in the rain. When we watch videos together, which we've done ever since the first day I met him, he explains these things to me, balance, anticipation, patience. These are all vital, peripheral vision, seeing things you've never seen before, kinesthetic sensation, driving by the seat of your pants. But what I've always liked best is when he talks about having no memory. No memory of things he'd done just a second before, good or bad, because memory is time folding back on itself. To remember is to disengage from the present. In order to reach any kind of success in automobile racing, a driver must never remember. Which is why drivers compulsively record their every move, their every race with cockpit cameras, in-car video, data mapping. A driver cannot be a witness to his own greatness. This is what Denny says. He says racing is doing. It is being a part of a moment and being aware of nothing else but that moment. Reflection must come at a later time. The great champion, Julian Cevallarosa, has said, when I am racing, my mind and my body are working so quickly and so well together, I must be sure not to think, or else I will definitely make a mistake.
Now, someone I know who races cars read that and said, you must have been a pretty good driver.
Well, I was better at talking about driving. I was a mid-pack guy. You know, if you want to be a top front of the pack, you have to devote yourself entirely. And I just didn't have the time or the funding to be able to do that. But it is true that a lot of the driving game, like a lot of athletics, and also artistic pursuits as well, and professional pursuits, it's a mental game, not just a skill. In other words, there's an art and a craft. And if you think of the craft being the skills that you need, the art is that extra bit, that inspiration, that thing that you don't know where it comes from. And really, that's what racing is all about. So it is a mental challenge. And we always get down on ourselves. We always tell ourselves, oh, I'm failing at this, and I can't believe I did that. And we're our own worst critics. And you have to divorce yourself from that. If you make a mistake in a turn on a racetrack, you can't pout and say, oh, woe is me, now I'm not going to do very well. You have to say, it's too late, I can't do anything about that. Now, what can I do to improve my position? And it's a very simple concept, but when I was racing, me and my racing buddies would hang out and, you know, talk about what we were, the weekend's race or something, and we'd say, you know, if we could apply those same rules to our lives, in our families and stuff, we'd be really good people. You know, we wouldn't get mad about something that happens. Let's just fix it. Let's let's not get bogged down in blame games and whose fault it is that this happens or that happens, because we do a lot of, you know, everybody does in their lives, you know.
So really, the art of racing in the rain is really the art of living, the art of writing. Is it how you write?
Yeah, well, I try. I mean, look, we all aspire to things. I mean, Enzo would, my narrator Enzo would say, you know, your reach must exceed your grasp, or what is heaven for, you know. We all must try to accomplish things. The quote that didn't make it into the book was the great champion Juan Manuel Fangio, who said, a racer must always strive to be the best, but never think that he is or she is. Because we always have to have a desire to better ourselves. And I think as people, we have to have that same thing. You know, we have to every day say, I am in a family relationship, every day one should wake up and say, I should be a better spouse for my partner. I should be better father or mother for my children, so that we try to live consciously and try to improve, as opposed to becoming complacent and kind of just going with the status quo.
You say that the quotation did not make it into the book, but you did basically write that in chapter 54, I think.
Yes.
Want to read that chapter?
Sure, I would. I before we move away from chapter 3, though, I have to tell you, it's one of the funny stories of this whole thing is I'm really bad at doing research. I mean, book research. I could do field research, but if I had the attention span, I probably could write nonfiction, but I can't. And so I just kind of usually make things up and then worry about it later. So when I was writing that chapter 3, I wanted to end it with this quote from a famous race car driver, but I didn't know who had said kind of what I wanted to say. So I just made it up and I put it in and let it go. And no one said anything. My early readers, my wife is always my first reader. She didn't say anything. Nope. My editor didn't, my agent didn't say anything. And it finally got all the way through editing, and it got to copy editing where they go through and have to verify all the details. And I got an email from the copy editor at the publisher saying, I'm just trying to do some fact-checking here. You quote this the great racing champion, Julian Sabatarosa, and we cannot find any races that this guy has won. I mean, she said, I've been just researching the internet constantly, and I can't find this guy. What was he champion of? And I said, well,
your imagination.
I said, here's the problem. He's my 7-year-old nephew. He doesn't drive.
Oh.
So I just made up a quote and gave my nephew's name to it, as a kind of a goof, and it made it into the book. I said to the copy editor, you know, by the way, this is fiction. There are a lot of real names in this book, but there are some that I put in there because I needed to bend the real world in order to make it work with my story. There's Julian Sabatarosa, and then there's the other one is the great Irish champion Kevin Finnerty York, who's a friend of mine, who's a semi-pro race car driver. He's never won the Grand Prix of Luxembourg, and he certainly didn't do it with two gears on his car. And in fact, they didn't even run the race of the year that I quoted in here.
So. Was your nephew thrilled to learn you his name?
Yes.
And your friend?
Yes. In fact, it was a big hit at his school. There was a book critic who at some point went up to my sister-in-law and said to her, so I was reading this book, and I didn't know your son was a race car driver. So that was a big laugh. But anyway, that's the fun of fiction. So this is chapter 54, which is near the end of the book. And this is where, see, Enzo tries to weave in the philosophies of, he tries to make it work, the philosophies of race car driving with the philosophies of life as displayed by Denny, because Denny gets involved in a lot of family drama that he then, in a sense...
It moves the book right along.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite a read.
So this is chapter 54. A driver must have faith in his talent, his judgment, the judgment of those around him, physics. A driver must have faith in his crew, his car, his tires, his brakes, himself. The apex sets up wrong. He is forced off his usual line. He carries too much speed. His tires have lost grip. The track has gotten greasy, and he suddenly finds himself at turn exit with no more track and too much speed. As the gravel trap approaches him, the driver must make decisions that will impact his race, his future. To tuck in would be devastating. Wrenching the front wheels against their nature will only spin the car. To lift is equally bad, taking grip away from the rear of the car. What is to be done? A driver must accept his fate. He must accept the fact that mistakes have been made, misjudgments, poor decisions. A confluence of circumstances has landed him in this position. A driver must accept it all and be willing to pay the price for it. He must go off track. To dump two wheels, even four, is an awful feeling, both as a driver and as a competitor. The gravel that kicks up against the undercarriage, the feeling of swimming in the muck. While his wheels are off the track, other drivers are passing him. They are taking his spot, continuing at speed. Only he is slowing down. At this moment, a driver feels a tremendous crisis. He must get back on the gas. He must get back on the track. Oh, the folly. Consider the drivers who have been taken out of races by snapping their steering wheels, by overcorrecting to extremes and spinning their cars in front of their competitors, a terrible position to find oneself in. A winner, a champion, will accept his fate. He will continue with his wheels in the dirt. He will do his best to maintain his line and gradually get himself back on the track when it is safe to do so. Yes, he loses a few places in the race. Yes, he is at a disadvantage, but he is still racing. He is alive. The race is long. It is better to drive within oneself and finish the race behind the others than it is to drive too hard and crash.
Is that your philosophy of life?
As I said, I would think I strive for that, sure. I mean, it really is true, the idea of overcorrecting on the track. There are instinctive things that your body has learned through the years. You know, the first time you're driving a car fast and you're going into a turn and the rear end of your car starts to step out, as they call it, which is starts to slide, a skid is initiated, the instinct is, oh, I'm going too fast, I've got to lift off the gas. And as soon as you do that, you're going to spin the car because you've changed the weight. It's all about weight transfer. Racing is all about weight transfer. So in fact, what you need to do is give it a little more gas because that sets the rear. There are ways of massaging that situation that you can teach yourself. But what is important is that we live thoughtfully, going back to that theme, as opposed to reacting emotionally. The emotional reaction is not always the best reaction. Now, passion is good, but rash emotion is not good on a racetrack or in a relationship, for instance. How often does someone get mad and say the wrong thing? When you look back on it, you know, an hour later, the next day, you say, oh, I should not have said that. I shouldn't have acted like that. If I could do it again without take the emotion out of it, I would have done it differently. So I guess, yes, that is my philosophy. I'm not saying that I can live like I mean, I try. I strive.
Now you have how many children?
Three. I have three children.
And they're?
My oldest is nearly getting his driver's license, so 16. He's almost 16. And then I have a 13-year-old and a 4.5-year-old. Or, I'm sorry, he would say 4 7/8-year-old.
You don't really look old enough to me to have somebody who is nearly getting his driver's license.
Oh, I'm old. I'm way old. See, that's it. I carry myself with my youthful demeanor. I'm 46 or 7. I can't. Let me see. 64. So I'm 47.
Well, that's, neither I nor most of my listeners would say that's very old. We're all amazed that people who were born in the 60s drive cars and get their driver's license.
Yeah.
Let alone that their children are starting.
Well, everything's changed, right? I mean, I heard someone on the radio talking about, you know, this middle-aged man of 42 years old. And I'm like, hey, middle-aged at 42. No. You're not middle-aged until you're like 60.
Right. I agree with that. The idea for this story, we've talked a little bit about how that idea, or how you chose Enzo as your narrator for all but the last chapter. Did you know Edeni?
Well, I've had friends who have gone through certain elements of this book, which I could then hyperbolize in order to utilize it as a fictional tool.
Are you saying that you've had friends who've had close relations who got sick?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have a very good friend whose wife died of a similar sort of brain cancer, and I've had a friend who was in a bad relationship that, there was a custody battle that really was very devastating. And so I kind of, see, you don't want to be friends or family members with a novelist, because they're going to just steal mercilessly. They just, whatever they can, they take. You know, I did kind of put together the story because, for a very specific reason. So there's that drama, the family drama. The other elements, so we've got the dog, and that, we'll tell you where that came from. And then the racing that came into it, because I had been racing, and also I was good friends with Kevin York, this friend of mine who I put in the book, who was living the life that Denny lived. He used to be in Seattle. He recently moved to North Carolina, but when he was in Seattle, he worked for a BMW repair shop, which is the shop that's in the book, and he worked behind the counter, and he taught on weekends, and he taught when he could, and he was always hustling for a ride. He had a family, but it was his passion. Racing is his passion, and so he's always, always trying to get on the track. And I thought, that's a real directed character, because you've got someone. There's no, it's like, what do you want to do today? I want to go to the track. There's no question of his commitment. That's where Denny came from, and then building the story around it. Well, when I teach writing workshops, I explain it to writers that the obstacles a hero must face in pursuit of his goal must be commensurate with the weightiness of the goal. So if Denny wants to be a Formula One champion, that's a very lofty goal. Enzo wants to be reincarnated as a person. I dare say that's a pretty lofty goal. The obstacles that these two protagonists have to overcome must really test our hero. Otherwise, it comes too easily. If the worst thing that happens to Denny is that he's, breaks his pinky toe and has to go to pinky toe rehab surgery for 3 weeks before he can get back in the race car, people are going to say, well, who cares? So I wanted to really ratchet up the drama, and that's why there's this, the custody of Zoe, custody of his daughter suit in there. I wanted Denny to really be faced with, the most difficult decision ever he could be, which is you can have racing or you can have your daughter, but you can't have both. And he says, no, I'm going to hold out until I get, because I want both. And so I had to develop a story then that would jeopardize his custody of his daughter. In the state of Washington, where I live and where the story is set, there are very few ways that a biological father can lose custody of his daughter upon the death of a spouse. And basically, you have to be in prison or a convicted felon, or if you are a sex offender. And those are kind of the two ways you can lose. So that's really why I built the story, which some people, I know some readers have said that it feels like it's over the top. I've heard from many family lawyers and others who say that it isn't. It happens all too frequently, these sorts of things. But that's why it had to be so, the drama had to be so extreme in order to really challenge our hero, so that when he comes through the end of it, we feel the catharsis that we need to feel at the end of a book.
The book has been tremendously successful. Have you been surprised at all?
Well, someone once asked me if the book is successful beyond my wildest dreams, and I said, my dreams get pretty wild. I think that it's every writer, when he or she sits down to write a book, wants to. We're doing it with the objective of reaching out and touching one reader. If we can get one person, if we can just get one person to just say, oh, wow, I was involved in this, and I went through the journey, and I felt this catharsis, and it's done something for me. I walk away feeling different about the world after I've read your book. All we need is one person doing that. The fact that now literally millions of people is extremely gratifying. But it is, as I say, we always strive for the best. So am I surprised? No, I'm very pleased. But I have high expectations for myself when I write a book. And in fact, I remember when I wrote the first draft of this and gave it to my wife to read, she read through the first draft and she looked at me and she said, Enzo is going to go around the world.
And he has.
31 or 2 languages. I'm not sure.
You talk about touching that one reader. Do you have a reader in your head as you're writing? Is there someone that you're writing to?
Not really, except that, I mean, in a sense, I'm writing a story that I would like to read, that I would get engaged with, this of the style that I enjoy. I do an awful lot of dialogue. I'm not so good about writing descriptions of leaves and the fauna of, I mean, some people are so beautiful the way they can write these descriptions. I tend to be more interested in the interpersonal dramas that are going on, and especially with this new book that I'm working on, which is a multi-generational family saga. After working on it for a couple of years now and getting through a whole draft, I realized where it's gotten flat is where I start summarizing and I start trying to remove myself too much from the scene, and I can make it an energetic scene with more dialogue and with more things at stake between the characters, it really reads a lot better. And I found it also reveals a lot more about the characters, and I learn as a writer a lot more about the characters. So that's part of my, you know, my thing.
A multi-generational book as the next work. Do you want to tell us just a little
bit
more about that?
Yeah, it takes place in the Northwest, and it deals with a lumber family based on some of the real families that is once extremely wealthy, very influential, and has since fallen from grace. And all they have left is a gigantic house built by the first father character in the story. But it's completely falling apart, and it's just, they don't have any money to keep it up, and it's really kind of disintegrating. And it's on this bluff overlooking Puget Sound. It's a very beautiful area just north of Seattle. It's narrated by a ghost. So it's narrated by one character, even though it spans 4 generations. So it's been real interesting to think about sort of the spiritual elements and bring that sort of discussion in, which is something I'm very interested in. It's in The Art of Racing in the Rain, surely, and not so much in my second book, but in my first book, Raven Stole the Moon, definitely deals with that sort of thing. And it's just been interesting to write this book. I'd like to say it's been fun to write it, but writing isn't always fun. It's great when it's fun, but it isn't always fun. Sometimes it's chopping wood. You just got to go do it. And, you know, you got to get the blisters on your hands. And sometimes you just think, oh, God, I really don't want to go chop wood today. But you have to. You have to get through the wood chopping so that you can get to the good stuff.
When do you think the next book will be coming out?
I had hoped to have it done already, honestly, but I'm not going to put out a book that isn't the best. It's funny, I was talking with a friend of mine, Jess Walter, who's a writer. His book, The Zero, was nominated for a National Book Award a few years ago. His new book is coming out, and I said, hey, Jess, is it any good? Which is like a horrible question to ask a writer, right? But I did it anyway. And he looks at me and he says, not only is it the best book that I've written, it's the best book anybody has ever written. That's the attitude. Whenever somebody says to me, what's your favorite book? And I say, it's the last thing I've done, the last book that I've done. And if it isn't, then that book isn't done yet. If that book isn't the best it could possibly be, the best thing I've ever written, then it's not fair of me to put it out there and ask someone else to read it. I'm asking a lot of a reader. I need your time. I need your attention. I need your focus. This day and age, I mean, with apps flying at us, you know, a million miles an hour, you know, there's so many channels on the TV and there's so many means of entertainment. Reading, you can't multitask. You know, it's a very personal experience. It's only done one person, one book at a time. And you can't wash the dishes while you're reading Moby Dick. You know, you can wash the dishes while American Idol is on in the background. But to read, I need your devotion. I need your full time.
All of you.
Yes. And therefore, I owe you something. If you're going to give me that, I have to give you something, which is I have to give you a story that you're going to be engaged with. It's going to be compelling. You're going to laugh. You're going to cry. And hopefully, you're going to think about something at the end of your experience. And you say, wow, that provoked me into thinking of something in a new way or looking at the world in some sort of an enlightened way. And I may fail, but I have to strive for that.
You mentioned an earlier book, Raven Stole the Moon. Is Raven Stole the Moon the one that has your mother in it, or was inspired by your mother?
It takes place in my mother's hometown of Wrangell, Alaska. And it has my grandmother in it from when I was a kid. I grew up in Seattle, but I would go up to Wrangell for the summers sometimes. And my grandmother lived to be 96. She was half Tlingit Indian, and she lived in her same house on Front Street there in Wrangell for her entire life, raised 11, well, she had 11 children, two of them died as infants, so she raised 9 kids in that house, and during the Depression and World War II and the whole thing. And so I set it up there, and I used a Tlingit Indian myth, which is Northwest Coast Natives. Raven is the sort of the patron saint. He is the creator of the world, and then populated it with people and gave us the sun and the moon and the stars. And there's a lot of myths and legends around that. And I took one of the lesser known, one of the obscure, like a lesser known Tlingit myth. Isn't that redundant? But the myth of the Kushtaka, which is a shapeshifter that was charged by Raven to watch over the souls of people who have died of drowning or of exposure, lost in the woods. And it's a story that's told by the Tlingits, or was told by the Tlingits in tradition, as a cautionary tale to kids. Don't play around the water. Don't run off into the woods, because if you do, then the Kushtaka will get you and steal your soul. So it's kind of this ambiguous story. Is the Kushtaka good, bad? There's some give and take there. But it's a story of a woman coming to terms with the drowning death of her child. And it delves into this magical realism in this world of mythology and in her quest to come to some sort of completion.
Was it written after you started having a family? There's a lot you have to say about the parent-child relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... If I thought too much about it, probably would go see a psychoanalyst, and then I'd probably get better adjusted, and then I wouldn't write books anymore. So I think it's my one. There's obviously something there. I keep on doing it. I did it in my second book as well, as a father-son story, and this new book is father-son-son-son-son.
Yeah. That's how Evan broke his head.
Yeah, yeah. That's about a 31-year-old rock musician in Seattle who is reunited with a 14-year-old son he didn't know he had. And so he has to, like, decide, is he going to become a father or not? Meanwhile, he has huge issues with his own father. And so it's a father and son coming of age thing.
With the success of The Art of Racing in the Rain, have people started to read the first two books as well?
Yes, they have. And I love it when... I know that sometimes on Amazon.com you see their little thing saying, well, his earlier books weren't as good as The Art of Racing in the Rain. And I understand. Look, we all develop as artists, I think, the more we do things. But I love it when I get an email from someone saying, I've read Raven and I've read Evan, and they both were so great. There's something about my main the characters that I feel... I call Raven Stole the Moon, the main character's name is Jenna. So I like it when someone meets Jenna again and gets to know her. And I like it when someone gets to know Evan and understands kind of the complicated nuances of his really messed up childhood and life. In terms of characters or in terms of themes, I see my arc. What's happened is, as a writer, I've learned to write with more economy, and I trust myself more. When I was writing my second book, How Evan Broke His Head and Other Secrets, a writer friend of mine, read a draft of it, and he gave me some feedback, and one of the things he said to me was, here's my suggestion, cut the last sentence of every paragraph in the book. And I started looking through it, and I said, you know, he's right, because when a writer doesn't trust him or herself, we overwrite because we think maybe the reader didn't get me, so I'm going to say it again just to make sure that they get me. It slows things down. It becomes repetitive. Oftentimes I will go through a book, and Lynn Hoffman, the writer named Lynn Hoffman, told me that. And sometimes I'll go through and I'll say, you know what? I should just start cutting last sentences.
Could you read just a little bit more for us?
Yes, I certainly can. There's so many fun things to read. I'm going to do this part, chapter 17. Your car goes where your eyes go. We went to Denny Creek, not because it was named after Denny, it wasn't, but because it was such an enjoyable hike, Zoe clumping along in her first pair of waffle stompers, me cut loose of my leash. Summer in the Cascades is always pleasant, cool under the canopy of cedars and alders, the beaten path packed down, making long strides easy. Off the beaten path, where dogs prefer a soft and spongy bed of fallen needles that rot and feed the trees with a steady trickle of nutrients. And the smell. The smell would have given me an erection if I'd still had testicles. Richness and fertility. Growth and death and food and decay, waiting, just waiting for someone to smell it, lingering close to the ground in layers, each distinct scent with its own aromatic weight, its own place. A good nose like mine can separate each odor, identify, enjoy. I rarely let myself go, practicing to be restrained like men are. But that summer, considering all the joy that we had, Denny's success and Zoe's exuberance and even Eve, who is light and free, I ran through those woods that day wildly, like a crazy dog, diving through the bushes, over the fallen trees, giving gentle chase to the chipmunks, barking at the jays, rolling over and scratching my back on the sticks and leaves and needles and earth. We made our way along the path, up and down the hills, over the roots and past the rock outcroppings, eventually arriving at the slippery slabs, as they were called, where the creek runs over a series of broad, flat rocks, pooling at some points, streaming at others. Children love the slippery slabs as they slide and slice through the sluices and slate. And so we arrived, and I drank the water cold and fresh, the last of that year's snowmelt. Zoe and Denny and Eve stripped down to their swimsuits and bathed gently in the waters. Zoe was old enough to safely navigate parts herself, and Denny took the lower and Eve took the upper, and they slid Zoe down the stream of water, Eve giving a push and Zoe slipping down. The rocks had traction when dry, but when wet, there was a film on them that made them quite slick. Down she would go, squealing and squirming, splashing into this frigid pool at Denny's feet. He would snatch her up and whisk her back to Eve, who would slide her down again and again. People, like dogs, love repetition. Chasing a ball, lapping a course in a race car, sliding down a slide, because as much as each incident is similar, so it is different. Denny rushed up the slab and handed off Zoe, returned to his spot by the pool. Eve lowered Zoe into the water. She screamed and flung herself in play, slid down the slab to be caught by Denny again. Until once, Eve dipped Zoe into the water, but instead of screaming and splashing, Zoe suddenly pulled her toes from the icy water, upsetting Eve's balance. Eve shifted her weight and somehow managed to release Zoe safely onto the dry rock, but her move was too abrupt, too sudden, an overcorrection. Her foot touched the creek, and she didn't realize how slippery those rocks were, slippery slabs like glass. Her legs went out from underneath her. She reached out, but her hand grasped only the air. Her fist closed, empty. Her head hit the rock with a loud crack and bounced. It hit and bounced like a rubber ball. We stood, it seemed like, for a long time, waiting to see what was going to happen. Eve lay unmoving, and there was Zoe, again the cause, not knowing what to do. She looked at her father, who quickly bounded up to them both. "Are you okay?" Eve blinked hard, painfully. There was blood in her mouth. "I bit my tongue," she said woozily. "How's your head?" Denny asked.
"It hurts."
"Can you make it back to the car?" With me in the lead, herding Zoe, Denny steered Eve. She wasn't staggering, but she was lost, and who knows where she would have ended up if someone hadn't been with her. It was early evening when we got to the hospital in Bellevue. "You probably have a minor concussion," Denny said, "but they should check it out." "I'm okay," Eve repeated over and over, but clearly she wasn't okay. She was dazed and slurring her words, and she kept nodding off, but Denny would wake her up, saying something about not falling asleep when you have a concussion. They all went inside and left me in the car with the windows open a crack. I settled into the pocket-like passenger seat of Denny's BMW 3.0 CSI and forced myself to sleep. When I sleep, I don't feel the urge to urinate nearly as badly as when I am awake. Always try and bring Enzo's dogness into a chapter like that. So,
no one will forgive me if I don't ask you. Do you have a dog?
Do I have a dog? Yes, Comet. Comet is my dog. She's wonderful, sweet, and she is not Enzo. Comet's the sweetest dog on the planet, but she just... Put it to you this way, Comet has a few more lifetimes to live as a dog before she's ready to come back as a person. Maybe in a couple lifetimes.
And Enzo's name.
Ah, Enzo's name, yes. Well, obviously Enzo's name is from Enzo Ferrari.
Ferrari.
The great car manufacturer and designer.
Garth Stein, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. This was fun.
I'm Patty Campbell. You've been listening to The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.